Okay, so I'm here with Levi Asher, who is the nominator of Triangle. Levi, what was it about this book that made you pick it?
Well, it's a very unusual book in that it's when you open it, you expect it to be about a sort of sad story of a tragic fire. And when you get a few pages in, you really see it takes a few sharp turns from there. And it becomes a story about a modern marriage in New York City, and then about a musician, an experimental musician, and it really confounds your expectations. And then by the end of it, I really felt it turned into a completely different type of book than I was expecting. And I like a book that can surprise me.
So for you, basically, it's really a matter of finding a sort of not-so-long book that surprises you, as opposed to a lengthy book that surprises you.
Well, I probably do have a predilection for shorter books, but yeah, it grabbed me right away. I will admit that I was attracted to the subject matter. I knew about the Triangle Fire, and it was probably the type of book I would have wanted to read, but I had much lower expectations. I really wasn't expecting such a clever, twisty sort of approach to fiction. And I wasn't familiar with Catherine Webber's work. I think she's really more experimental writer than one would know from seeing how the book is built.
If you weren't aware of her, how did you find out about this book?
Actually, a publicist sent it to me. Lauren Saran sent it. I do think I would have grabbed it anyway. I mean, the subject matter would have grabbed me, but I'm not sure if I would have put it on the top of my pile.
Do you find that a sort of historical subject that is, I guess, given this particular contextualization, is this the stuff that makes great fiction, or...?
No, I wouldn't say necessarily at all. In different hands, it could have been a really rotten book, and I bet Catherine could have written a good book about many different other types of disasters. I think it's all in the author's craft.
So really, it's more the execution rather than the subject matter.
Yeah, the subject matter was enough to get me to pick up the book. It wouldn't have gotten me through 10 pages, though. It really wouldn't have if the book didn't deliver. Yeah. And like I said, when you pick up a book that seems to be about a disaster, you expect it to hit certain familiar signposts. And once you get a few chapters in, you really can be confused by this book. You know, where is it going? Are we in 1911, which is when the Triangle Fire took place, or are we in modern New York City? It goes back and forth, and she really doesn't tie it up at all, I would say, which is what the best books don't do. You know, you don't really have to tie it all up. I think she just leaves a very strong impression with the reader.
Well, thanks very much, Levi. Okay, so I am here with Catherine Webber, who is the author of the Lit Blog Co-op selection, Triangle. Catherine, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Apologize for my voice, but we'll get through this. First off, I actually wanted to ask you about the patterns of this book. Obviously, you have this moment where George actually says, I kind of want to stay away from Fibonacci sequences because everyone who is anyone is writing a Fibonacci novel or opening a Fibonacci restaurant or laying a Fibonacci sidewalk or weaving a sweat lodge from recycled industrial waste in a Fibonacci form, even as we speak. So, I have to ask you, is Triangle, since it's galvanized by this mystery, the book is almost, in a sense, possibly a Fibonacci spiral, or perhaps a Sierpinski triangle?
It's more like a Sierpinski triangle, or maybe it's neither of those things, but it forms its own pattern, depending on repetition, the way music depends on repetition. It has a musical kind of repetition and echo, theme and variation and variation and variation. I have to tell you that after the book was published, I realized that someone I knew had just created a Fibonacci sidewalk, and I had to convince him that I had written that before he had the idea. He actually literally made a Fibonacci proportioned sidewalk out of sections of bluestone and thought he had invented it, but I got there first in the novel.
That's true. There's also the movie Pi as well that has the Fibonacci spiral.
I mean, I actually wasn't familiar with.
Oh, okay.
But I'm very aware that there's something so delightful about the Fibonacci sequence that people keep discovering it and appropriating it.
Yeah. I mean, structurally, I guess, did you have this kind of idea in mind of a triangle or a circle, or did you kind of come to, was this heavily structured?
Well, Triangle was the name of a shirtwaist company. Sure. I have never been able to determine why they called their company Triangle.
Really?
I would love to know, but I don't know. Cynthia Ozick pointed out to me that two triangles make a Jewish star, but I don't think that was what they had in mind. I am very aware that that was handed to me and then I built on it, but in fact there are many, many triangles both in the historic truth of what happened and in my novel. So, you know, in fact, at the trial for which the bosses were, you know, acquitted of all charges, they stood trial for one death, one murder, which represented all, but there was one named person and they were found innocent of having caused her death. But one of the ways they won was that the defense attorney got a key witness, an immigrant with a thick Yiddish accent, to repeat her story three times to prove that it was rehearsed, which it was, but that doesn't mean it wasn't true testimony. But he was able to undercut the credibility of the story by proving that she said the same thing three times. So that happened historically, and I used it
in
the novel, in my trial transcript where my fictional character testifies. There were three floors of the Triangle Waste Company, the 8th, 9th, and 10th floor. Mm-hmm. You know, there are threes in my story as well, which is to say George, Rebecca, and Esther, Esther, Pauline, and Jacobs, Esther, Pauline, and Sam. You have Rebecca, George, and the incredibly irritating Ruth Zion. You know, so there are many threes. The book is in three parts. There are three interviews with Ruth Zion. You know, and I'm sure I could keep going and find you some more threes.
Well, I was also
I was building on the triangle of Triangle.
I was also going to point out, like, concerning the interview transcripts, the sense I got from those is that actually the reader is essentially the triangulator for those particular two sorts of series. And yet, you're also
You're
dealing also with this situation where the questions are being excised through this questions in brackets. I'm wondering how that particular transcript format came about, because you're trying to figure out what she could have possibly said to basically sort of, you know, uproot Esther from her equanimity.
But don't you think you know kind of what she said?
You do kind of.
Contextually?
Know. Contextually, you do.
I didn't want to give Ruth a voice. I wanted her voice to be implicit. And I could cook up lots of literary reasons for those choices now, but I can only tell you that when I was writing it, it was an instinctive, it felt like the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. So there are always ways to come up with the lit crit analysis after the fact, which is what other people do to me, and I could also do it myself. Yeah. But I can only tell you there was no grand theory about her voice. I wanted her voice to come through, even though you never knew what she asked. I mean, you got a strong sense of her personality and her voice from those transcripts.
Gotcha. But also Ruth, who's a fascinating character, also comes through resoundingly clear during her encounters with the two. And I was actually particularly fascinated with her because, you know, she initially, she just has a particular vernacular, very much like Esther, in the sense these two have the most voiced vernaculars, and yet every time they sort of come up, it's largely in this colloquy sort of format. And I'm wondering, you know, because you have Esther sort of developing her English over the course of the years, and
you encounter Ruth. Her at different ages where her language changes as she is here longer.
Yeah.
So her earliest use of English is in the trial transcript when she is at her youngest.
Yes.
The book begins with her 50th anniversary transcribed recollection. She's already told the story for 50 years. So it's not just that she's been speaking English for 50 years, but she's been speaking the language of the Triangle Fire. She's been telling the story and telling the story. So what interested me wasn't just developing her use of English, but her developing and mutating over time relationship to the story and how it stuck to the story and how she wandered off the story and got details wrong over time. And we all get details wrong over time. If you now had to describe to me every moment of a car accident you were in 30 years ago, you know, even if you think that's what happened, it might not match the police report.
Sure.
And you may have changed it because someone saw something that you didn't actually experience, but now you've incorporated it into your experience, and it becomes part of your telling of the story. So I'm interested in how we tell our stories, the agenda we bring to the telling, but also so much of the novel is about the agenda we bring to the listening to stories, how we ask our questions with agendas as much as we tell our stories with agendas.
Well, where I was going with this, Ruth also has a very sort of specifically stylized academic vernacular. In fact, she even uses the non-word irregardless at one point.
Yes.
I found her quite...
A word that I should tell you was, you could say... fuck in the house where I grew up. You could you could say anything, but you couldn't say irregardless.
Good.
That was a forbidden word.
Well, I mean, the point I was mentioning here is that these two very stylized vernaculars are the ones that are found in the transcript. And I found that to be a very interesting choice in the relationship between this kind of what is the objective truth and what is the subjective truth. It's almost as if the objective nature, supposedly, of these transcripts or these articles are very much subjective. And maybe you can talk about why that particular... And also, when Rebecca and Ruth actually meet up with each other for the first time, you actually go away from description with that. It's largely all just dialogue. A lot of questions to throw at you, but I wanted to sort of get your thoughts in terms of the design of
this. As a writer, you know, this is my fourth novel.
Yes.
As a writer, I've always found character in voice. Whether or not the novel is literally in the first person, it's always been the voice that is how I locate the character, how I inhabit the character, how I move the character, develop him or her, you know, through the plot points of the story. Mm-hmm. And in a way, because Triangle so much depends on artifact, whether it is the artifact of a trial transcript or an interview transcript or a newspaper article or a transcribed recollection for a 50th anniversary ILGWU pamphlet, which I should tell you I have had probably some 20 inquiries now about from scholars, many of whom write me emails that end with .edu, asking for that pamphlet which the novel opens, because the ILGWU doesn't have it, and it's not in the Evo archives, and it's not in the Kiel archives, and it's not in any database they've searched, so they're wondering if I could share this or provide a photocopy. And I can only say in a very polite way, well, yes, you said you enjoyed my novel, and that was fiction too, and I still don't understand how a fictional character could have testified in an authentic document. It's very satisfying to me that I have, in effect, counterfeited historical artifacts.
Yeah.
It interests me how much we depend on artifacts to understand what has happened. And whether it's what has happened in your family when you read the love letters that show that your father loved someone else, not your mother, or the Rosetta Stone, which is an artifact and a document and contains information that we use to understand other information. I'm really interested in how we think we know history, how we record history, how we think we understand what's happened and who said what to whom. And so I'm interested in artifact. And then as a novelist, I'm interested in using artifact to tell a story. And voice is in artifact. I mean, whether it's in the transcript of a presidential address or, you know, the transcript of important, you know, congressional debates. I mean, that's how we record is, you know, voice, whether it's written or recorded and then written. And it interests me very much as a way of telling story, as a way of writing a novel that is about how people tell their stories and what parts of stories we want to hear and what parts of stories we don't really want to hear, even when they're right in front of us.
It's interesting you mention this, because I actually saw, you know, George's symphony. It reminded me very much of Clive's Millennium Symphony in Ian McEwan's Amsterdam. And, of course, in Enduring Love, Ian McEwan had that psychological fabrication that people likewise also thought was true. And when he had to basically, you know, sort of say, you realize this
is fiction.
I made
it up. He also wrote about Huntington's disease in Saturday.
Yeah.
Well, I can only say with interest that if I were a man, I think my novels would have been compared to Ian McEwan sooner than right now.
Oh, wow. No one else has actually made that comparison?
No.
Is Ian McEwan a large influence for you? Or?
Not a large influence, but I certainly pay attention to him. I'm just aware that when critics want to make a comparison, they tend to go hunting for female authors when they're writing about female authors.
Oh, interesting. You found that to be the case with all of your books?
Yes.
Really?
Absolutely.
Wow.
The British press kept comparing my second novel to Brian Moore, but that certainly didn't strike anyone on this side of the ocean.
Wow.
I was thrilled. I mean,
I assure you, there are some critics who are, you know, gender neutral in terms of like this whole.
Is anyone gender neutral?
Well, that's the question. Is if Ruth is clearly not, so you know, shows the other side of the coin.
Which is about agenda.
Yeah,
again,
Ruth is
looking for the story she's looking for, and she's not going to be interested in anything else along the way. And she's very territorial, and she's got that blinkered inside the Academy way of focusing on her agenda and solving the needs of her agenda at all costs. She's also not terribly sympathetic in some ways, but in other ways, I wanted the reader to have a guilty identification with her because she's asking questions in her own flat-footed way that you would like to have the answers to also. Mm-hmm. It's just that you wouldn't necessarily ask those questions that way.
Sure, sure. But there's the other thing that's interesting about Ruth and George in the sense that they kind of both approach their respective sort of mediums from similar angles in terms of this deconstructive approach. And yet Rebecca responds favorably to George because it's in the housing works of art, and unfavorably to Ruth because it's in this sort of historian or scholarship and dubious imprint.
But Ruth is dead and George is alive. Ruth is a dreary academic stuffing information into boxes where she can lock them into those boxes and put the boxes into rows. George has an aesthetic response to the world. He has a kind of synesthesia from which his music derives. So he's writing music based on forms found in nature, whether it's a tide table or a labor contraction or a DNA sequence. But ultimately, he's making something that's pleasing and beautiful. And it's a system, yes, but it's not about system. It's about musicality. And he's a very traditional composer using traditional instruments of an orchestra. He's not using synthesizers or electronics.
It seemed to me that it was more about the difference between them, was more about emotion. For example, the segment of the piano that he plays on the piano about, you know, that he was working on uncompleted to his friend, you know, in the funeral hall, has this remarkable sort of emotional sort of response from everyone.
Yeah.
And that to me seems sort of the major difference. Similarly, without giving away what happens with the window near the end. I mean, that to me seemed the difference, but I wanted to, you know, you're saying then, I guess, that really it does actually depend on the medium more so than this kind of empathy or actually a sense of humor about the world.
He absorbs information. He's about information in a way that the way Ruth is, which is to say DNA is information when he starts writing portraits based on DNA. I mean, he's transposing information from one format into another, but it's being extruded through his sensibility and it's coming out as exquisite, incredibly appealing, pleasurable music, and that is ultimately what he is creating, using information, using a system, but he's not about information and systems per se.
Yeah. But it's also, he is also going into an abstract form, whereas Ruth is going into this really concrete sort of form.
The more concrete, the better.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so is it, I mean,
it's very reductive, you know. So she thinks something might be so, and then the next moment it is so, and then she builds on that.
I'm wondering if Ruth was based off of any specific sort of academic figure, or did anyone actually offer you desiccated poppy seed cake at some point? Or?
No. Ruth, you know, it's funny. People who don't spend a lot of time in academia think she's this grotesque caricature, but people who go to MLA conferences routinely know that they are packed with the Ruth Zions of this world, speaking at symposia after symposia, presenting paper after paper. It's very interesting to get Amazon reviews by people who seem to identify with Ruth Zion in a very defensive and irritable way.
Maybe it's just me. I found her to be a very interesting character. I didn't find her to be a terrible person. I just found her to be just really bizarrely idiosyncratic and just maybe completely socially inept, but still, I didn't find this to be it.
She's not a bad person.
Yeah.
She's after the right things. Her heart is in the right place, but she is not a very socially developed person, so she's unsympathetic in those ways. And she's not the least bit sensitive to the issues for Rebecca. You know, she's really very territorial about this material. You know, I have encountered people who are scholars of George Gershwin. George Gershwin, in some ways, is a spirit who hovers over this novel, I should say. My grandmother was the songwriter Kay Swift, who was George Gershwin's great love interest. She lived to be almost 96, and well into her 90s, she was just an oracle of information about, you know, a font of, you know, the last person who could tell you the precise tempi for every number in Let 'Em Eat Cake, you know. And people would come to her, Gershwin scholars, musical theater scholars, and some of them were very, very territorial because they had chosen an area to study and they knew everything about it. And yet, you know, here she was, the person who had the 10-year romance with George Gershwin. But, you know, but what does she know? She just said it happened in September when I know it happened at the beginning of October. You know, so they would have their facts and facts and facts in a little better order than she did in her 90s. But it was her experience. It was her life. And they were kind of competitive with her about it. And they would also ask her the questions that interested them, that focused narrowly on the thing they were there to hear about. So if she started to tell a story about Harold Arlen to someone who's only really interested in what happened when Pardon My English was a flop, you know, they would close her off. They didn't want to hear about that. They only wanted to hear about this. So I was very aware of those people. And then similarly, I was very close for many years with Annie Albers, who was one of the last of the Bauhaus teachers. And there would be these scholars who would come to call on her. She was at Black Mountain after the Bauhaus. But if they were Bauhaus people, the Black Mountain didn't interest them. And if they were Black Mountain people, if she started to tell a story about the time Mies van der Rohe came to dinner, they weren't interested. You know, again, it was this narrow, almost like a biopsy kind of desire to extract the marrow of information with no awareness for the larger human experience of a life lived. So I gave Ruth those characteristics. More recently, someone wrote a biography of my grandmother that was published by Yale Press, and I found her agenda sometimes very frustrating because I felt that she was more interested in gender issues than in a larger picture where I have to say, my grandmother was a staff composer at Radio City. She wrote routines for the Rockettes. If you don't like the Rockettes or you don't approve of the Rockettes, then maybe this isn't your material to write about. But to write about the Rockettes in a disapproving way because of the gender issues, you know, life is more fun than that.
This explains quite a lot. So would you say that Triangle, I guess, came out of these kinds of motivations that were hovering in the air?
I taught at Yale for 8 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've always been a person who's on the edge, which is to say, my Protestant relatives think I'm Jewish, my Jewish relatives think I'm Protestant. My academic colleagues thought of me as an eccentric novelist, but my novelist friends persist in regarding me as an academic because of some of the teaching I've done. You know, so it's very interesting to always have that insider-outsider perspective. But if you spend time on the Yale campus or any other campus, the Ruth Zions present themselves to you, and you soon know that what some people might regard as a caricature is actually very, very ordinary.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I felt with Ruth Zion, you were pushing it just enough of, like, the PowerPoint, but it was, you reached a certain sort of spot where I could actually, at first I was like, oh, she may go for the sort of cheap shot, but then I'm like, wait a minute, I could actually sort of buy this, because you have conversations with these various people. And bringing back to this sort of personal comparison you made in terms of, like, people who don't have the broader human experience, this makes sense with George, because he's applying music and merging it with science. And therefore, there's this more kind of broad sort of spectrum that perhaps causes him to have this sense of humor about this final, you know, dialogue in the apartment.
And George, who shares his first name with George Gershwin,
yes,
shares also with George Gershwin, although his music in my mind is nothing like Gershwin's music, but he shares a similar sort of incredible genius in various directions that the public doesn't quite know what to do with. And I was actually paraphrasing some of the critical response to Gershwin in his lifetime in some of the ways I characterized the critical response to George Botkin, which is to say, is it high, is it low, what is it, we don't know what to do with it, because if it's really intellectual, then why is it so fun and pleasurable, and we are suspicious of that in our culture. So I was playing with that in a certain way.
Well, what of like all these sort of private financial individuals who come to George for these million-dollar symphonies? I mean, did that come from Gershwin? Did that come from some other sort of...
Well, arts patronage is interesting. Yeah. You know, I'm married to someone who writes about crazy rich people who are arts patrons, Nicholas Fox Weber. You know, if when you're really, really rich and you really, really are interested in art, that's where our culture comes from. You know, I mean, those are the people who build museums. And if they give their collection because they're trying to pay off a tax debt or whatever, I mean, our cultural institutions are built by robber barons. You know, people do the right thing for the wrong reasons all the time. And that's interesting.
No accident, too, that George is also MacArthur Genius Grant as well. Yeah. You know, I mean, actually, MacArthur finances Harper's. Without the MacArthur Foundation, Harper's would not exist, you know?
And, of course, the MacArthur grants aren't necessarily good for artists, because if you were to really study, just thinking about novelists who have received grants, I wonder whether, in the long run, it has been enough money to make a difference, or whether it's really something that causes a kind of disequilibrium that's very hard to recover from. It's kind of a two-edged
blade. That's certainly what happens with a lot of MacArthur writers. Like, a lot of them sort of stop writing or don't produce a novel after like seven, 10 years.
And then they kind of lose momentum. Yeah. No, it's interesting. And of course, I'm not saying you should be hungry in order to write well, but... being told that you're a genius, here, have a whole bunch of money, isn't necessarily the way to write well either. But going back to Ruth's larger-than-lifeness, I'm intrigued by something as a reader, which is, as a reader, I like to read novels about people who aren't just like people I would meet or know or who would live down the street. But I have seen Ruth Zion criticized because, unlike all the other characters in the novel, she's a little too much. She's a little unusual. She's a little bit of a caricature. There's a little... She looms a little too large. As if somehow there's been a decision made in the culture that I missed, that characters in novels are really, really good if they're really, really, really just like real people. But if they loom a little large, or if they seem a little too much, too extreme, too... you know, sort of essence of some personality quirk, then we don't like them as much because they seem like something in a novel. They seem fictional. They have what I would call symptoms of fiction, when somehow the idea that George can write music that inspires pregnant women to go into labor and give birth is somehow accepted as realistic, but Ruth Zion is seen as unrealistic. And I'm really interested that these days novels are supposed to be authentic, and it's supposed to be like something that really happened, unless you're writing magical realism, in which case the gravity can be turned off and you can do this other thing. And I don't think that used to be true, which is to say, most characters in Iris Murdoch, most characters in Muriel Spark, I mean, you know, let's talk about Edith Wharton, you know, Undine Sprague, one of the most despicable women in contemporary literature, you know. Well, isn't Undine Sprague a little too much? You know, aren't most Dickens characters a little extreme? And that's why we refer to certain kinds of people as Dickens characters.
Yeah. Well, there's also this idea now that if you write a so-called literary novel about a major historical event, that it must be entirely stern and serious and austere.
And it should be like a daguerreotype.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I mean, and with this, I felt that, you know, Ruth Zion offered this very interesting sort of comic relief that still fits thematically into the larger question of subjective versus objective.
This is not a historic novel. It is not a period novel. It is a very contemporary novel, which takes up an event that happened in 1911 and is still happening into the present moment. And it is, of course, also echoing off of the events of September 11th.
Yeah.
So it's sometimes the case that readers respond to a novel. I don't mean to sound as defensive as I think I may be sounding, because I keep taking up ways that the novel has been criticized, but of course most novelists fixate on those comments more than on all the heaps of praise. And certainly it's been a very successful book, critically, in all ways. I mean, it's been a wonderful experience to have my fourth novel be as recognized as it has been. But there's something that happens. I don't know whether you would have an idea about that, about the way people expect a novel to be like this. And then if the novel isn't like this, it's like that, then they'll review it or talk about it against the fantasy of what it was supposed to be or what they thought it was. So I thought this novel was going to be like this, and then it turned out to be like that. So, I'm going to describe the novel I thought it was going to be and maybe should have been, or I would have written if I had written this novel. You know, so for instance, there are many people who think they're reading this novel about the Triangle Fire, and then there's all this music. What is all this music doing in this novel about the Triangle Fire? And that presupposes what a novel about the Triangle Fire is supposed to be, or even that this is a novel, quote, about, unquote, the Triangle Fire.
My theory about this is that it has a lot to do with this regrettable sort of critical community of people who view exclusively reactionary sort of terms for what the novel should be. The sort of James Wood, Daniel Mendelsohn, they're both fine critics, but they still, you know, are looking to classics or Richard Yates or things that are a really hardcore realist. And this kind of attitude, I think, has floated around in the air enough because, you know, from this cultural sort of thing. And Cynthia Ozick, as a matter of fact, kind of identified this too in an essay she wrote in Harper's actually a few months ago. Very much that what is acceptable in books is very much, in a weird way, still dictated by the critical community in terms of literature. And perhaps these really sort of restricting terms cause people to sort of see it something like, oh, you know, we can't have a sort of slightly, idiosyncratic,
over the top
character. Yeah. I mean, you know, maybe as a novelist, you can maybe describe how is this even a factor for novelists? Do you just have to constantly just write true to your voice and not worry about these sorts of things? Or is this going to be a problem in the future for emerging talents? I mean, I'm going to be talking actually today as well with Antoine Wilson, who wrote this fabulous novel called The Interloper. And same thing. I thought it was a fine novel, but because it was a little quirky, he had to go to the other press to actually get this published. And I really think it should have been published in a major house, you know?
Well, I think there are lots of different things in play because I think the young writer, the new writer, tends to write in the moment because we're all in our own moment. I mean, you can't write a 1920s novel. Susan Minot certainly made a good attempt at one with Evening, but it's a 1990s, 1920s novel. You know, you can only ever write in the time in which you are living now. But I do think that young, new, emerging writers tend to unconsciously jump into the zeitgeist stream. And so the trend that may be market-driven becomes, I think, driven further by a sense of this is what writing is, this is what storytelling is, this is how narrative is constructed. So it's not necessarily conscious imitation, it's not necessarily writing toward a market, but if certain things are prominent because of what the market drives to the top, drives to the bottom, permits, doesn't permit, then what's going to join that conversation, what's going to harmonize with that is going to come along. And there will always be the outliers. But I do think we are living in a time now where stuff that really happened to real people is valued more than stuff that somebody made up. Thus, so-called reality television. The idea that you are privy to Survivor or Big Brother or any of these other allegedly reality-based shows, although they're so scripted and edited into narrative, somehow trumps the idea of watching a narrative that was written out of someone's imagination and then performed by talented actors, supported by a crew. Somehow we have this almost voyeuristic need to think we're seeing something that maybe we wouldn't ordinarily be privy to, and we're not going to be just manipulated and fooled by a cooked up fiction. We're seeing something that's more like pornography, and to me it has all the conceits of pornography, because if you think about something like Big Brother, you're seeing something that you wouldn't ordinarily see, and these people are allegedly behaving spontaneously just for each other, not for the audience. But of course, the whole thing exists entirely for the audience, and it has been much more scripted than it acknowledges, while Law and Order acknowledges that it is a drama. You know, Grey's Anatomy, you know, is a drama with an ensemble cast. And although, sure, those things are popular and people like them, I think we live in a time, and I think this affects very much the books that succeed, the books people love, where there's a suspicion of something that's just a made-up story, while there's a little more value if it might be a made-up story, but it's got real facts in it. And whether those real facts are about Jamestown or about the Triangle Fire or the Titanic, you know, it really happened to real people. So even if I'm reading a novel about it, I'm getting a nonfiction book's worth of information. So that's more nutritious. And I do think we live in a time where if something is only the product of somebody's imagination, that is seen as having less value.
Less value, or perhaps more veracity to it. You know, you're talking about this notion of people actually, scholars coming to you, asking for this fictitious, clearly fictitious, you know.
These documents.
Documents and everything that you resorted to. And it's the same thing happened recently, like with Marion Wiggins' latest novel, where she put a character named Marion Wiggins in there. And everybody said, this must therefore be exactly who Marianne Wiggins is. It's almost like my theory about this, and sorry for the great aside here, is that it's kind of like, because of the whole James Frey nonsense, because memoirs now have this kind of, you know, you now have a memoir, you open it up, and there's like this disclaimer at the beginning, as if you can't sort of take any kind of liberty without some sort of, you know, legal sort of situation. The novel, therefore, has become this kind of refuge to play around with truths in a place where you were able to before actually play around with them in creative nonfiction. I mean, do you have any thoughts?
Well, going back to James Frey, something made me very angry over and over again in the James Frey discussions, which is the idea that, oh, he made it up, he lied, so it's not nonfiction, it's fiction. When that's not true. It wasn't fiction. The question wasn't nonfiction versus fiction. The question was honest versus dishonest. It was dishonest. It was a misrepresentation. And lies and misrepresentations are not the same thing as fiction. So the idea that, oh, we just relabeled that book and put it on a different shelf in the bookstore and now we know what it is, to me was immensely frustrating. Because what he did wasn't write a novel and call it a memoir. What he did was a deliberate deception that was particularly painful, I think, to the readers who were reading that memoir as a story of addiction being overcome. And so it was deeply dishonest and in some ways very destructive, but I think also very destructive for all of us who write novels and memoirs, because it completely muddied the conversation and the definitions of what those things are and aren't.
Yeah. Do you think people are able to actually go to the novel and recognize that there are no absolutes here? I mean, if you're getting this kind of reaction to Triangle in terms of like, well, this clearly must be based on some really serious research paper.
Well, you know, as a novelist, my heart sinks if someone reads anything I've ever written and comes away from it with the thought, oh, she certainly must have done a lot of research, because I think novels should wear their research very, very lightly. And at the same time, I'm very aware that with this novel, I am selling books to people who don't read novels but are really interested in the Triangle Fire or in New York City history or in labor history or in Jewish history or in fire history. I've had firefighters come to readings and sit in the back row in uniform with the fire engine parked out front of the library.
That's fantastic.
It's fantastic. So I am very aware that even if I think I'm a novelist talking about a novel, I'm going to end up having a lot of conversations about the Triangle Fire, about labor unions, about building codes, and I can do that. I know that stuff. And it's a way, I hope, to get people who don't normally read novels, you know, to read this novel. But I think it can be confusing that they're reading a novel. I also think for a lot of people, reading novels with a historic element, it's as if there's some belief that the way to read this novel is to try to sort out which is the stuff that really happened and which is the part that was made up. And I think that's a pretty threadbare way to read a novel. I just don't think that's a very fulfilling way to approach a novel.
Do you feel, though, that jamming all this stuff into like a majestic triangles within triangles and all that, that this is the way to, I guess, get people to read outside of this fact versus fiction in terms of the larger thematics that you actually bring to the table?
It's certainly a way to comment on how people read. You know, my previous novel was a modern retelling of Little Women, where I had the real people on whom the characters were based commenting through the novel. Mm-hmm. And it was a way of talking about how people read a novel looking for the real people and the real events that must be driving this story, and giving the real people a voice, although of course they were also fictional creations. And because that novel begins with a disclaimer from the fictional author of the novel within the novel, that these reader's notes and author's notes in response are legally required as a condition of publication, but the common reader who has no vested interest in this has the author's every encouragement to ignore these notes because they're intrusive and they're regrettable. So please feel free just to ignore them, says the character in the novel who wrote the novel. And then I would meet with book group after book group where there would always be some people who had not read approximately a third of the text of the novel. Why? Because a character in the novel told them not to. So the joke was on me in that I thought I had written a novel that was commenting on how you can't control how people read your novel, and I couldn't control how people read that novel either.
Reminds me very much of The Introduction to Giles Goatboy by John Barth.
John Barth is a huge influence on me. I think Floating Opera was one of the most important novels I read as a teenager.
Wow. I actually just recently reread that. I'm on this like rereading old Barth. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Well, what about Giles Goatboy?
About the editor's notes at the beginning, where there's like all these editors basically arguing each other about whether we should publish this or whether this is actually real, or, you know, and this again is, I mean, I can only imagine if this book were to come out in today's climate, where there's this great sort of obsession with what are the real facts, or in fiction, are there things that are based on truth? I think maybe it goes down to this whole based on a true story thing, maybe, that people are really willing to buy this. We've had the whole mantra based on a true story thrown at us over the last 20 years. Yeah. You know, inevitably people are now approaching the novel thinking, oh, well, this deals with the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. So therefore, this must therefore be based on a true story.
Yes, and in some ways I came to regret that I had ever revealed to my publisher that my paternal grandmother worked at the Triangle in 1909 finishing buttonholes, because there were then people who wanted to talk about the book as inspired by her grandmother's experience, you know, which is true but really not true, and I certainly didn't set out to write a novel about my grandmother, although it's one of the reasons the Triangle Fire has always been something I had a very vivid awareness of growing up in New York City, because my grandmother didn't die in the Triangle Fire, as most people didn't. As the tens of thousands of women who worked in the needle trades all over New York City didn't, only 146 did. But for all who could have been there that day, it's a very personal fire. But there was this confusion about my grandmother, and I certainly saw readings heralded with the erroneous and very regrettable statement, you know, inspired by my grandmother's experience surviving the Triangle Fire. So again, it's as if the novelist is just someone who writes stuff down. If there's anything in it in the novel that really happened, then there's this assumption that it all happened, or somehow, again, there's this aura around the parts that are real versus the parts that are only the product of the novelist's imagination.
But to play partial devil's advocate here, I mean, clearly and arguably, your grandmother's experience was in some way perhaps a launching point, or at least a sort of construct which you could invent or launch from or whatnot.
Sure, a what if.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of what ifs. But, you know, my first novel, first person, a photographer in her 20s, goes to Geneva and discovers that her best friend is having an affair with an older married man who's an Auschwitz survivor. And she herself has grown up in a world of survivors, Holocaust survivors. I grew up in Forest Hills Gardens, surrounded by people with numbers on their arms and accents. That doesn't mean I am the character in the novel. It doesn't mean that the character wrote the novel. And even if there's this assumption that it is autobiographical in ways that it really, truly was not, when my second novel was about an Irish-American woman who gets involved with a plot to steal a Vermeer from the Queen with an IRA splinter group, I had hoped that that would kind of cancel out the Holocaust survivor identity, because now I'm an Irish-American woman raised by policemen in a Boston suburb getting involved with an IRA plot. But no, when I did readings for that, the questions would be, is it autobiographical? And, you know, is it autobiographical? Have I been involved with an IRA splinter group stealing a Vermeer from the Queen? No. You know, but there is an assumption that a really authentic first-person voice must be autobiographical, whatever you have written. And it's part of your experience or part of somebody's experience that you have appropriated in some way. And again, I can only say stocks are up in It Really Happened to Somebody and stocks are down in You Made It Up.
Yeah, yeah. No, I actually have on the blog right now, there's this comment thread where I wrote something that was clearly satirical and people are now inferring all these psychological things about me. I don't get it. But
I think you should go with that.
Yeah,
I think you should let them name syndromes after you.
Exactly.
I think that it should be in the DSM-5.
They will be a Weber syndrome. Yeah, exactly. Actually, speaking of, based on real events, I wanted to actually ask you if the 2003 Station nightclub fire was in any way a sort of influence in considering or recontextualizing the
Great White Fire.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
No, I was already working on the novel. It was a horror because people were trapped there. I was intrigued by it and saddened by it, but it, not specifically. No, I mean, I say that, and then maybe unconsciously, I read one more article of someone describing not being able to breathe in the smoke that affected a sentence of how I wrote about not being able to breathe in smoke. I don't know, but fires where people are trapped certainly interested me while I was writing the novel. Above all, September 11th came along when I had already begun to develop Triangle. And that seemed like the most hideous mirror of them all, because it was only the second time in New York City history that such a large number of people were trapped at the top of a building in a workplace fire with the expectation that they would be rescued, and they weren't. And proportionately, about 146 people died in the Triangle Fire, probably a few more than that. Of those, about 60 jumped to their deaths. The World Trade Center, the best estimate is plus or minus, about 200 people jumped to their deaths. So in fact, at the Triangle Fire, a greater proportion chose to jump instead of die another way. But the parallels were really extreme for me, reading and watching and hearing about that.
But in also deciding to leave the September 11th card, kind of really deeply embedded in the text.
Well, Ruth Zion brings it up.
Well, yeah, exactly. Of course, go figure. I mean, this kind of also gets into this question of whether, September 11th takes away from tragedies like Triangle, or actually, even if I use the word tragedy, then we get into semantics, but terrible events like the Triangle Fire, or like the Great White Fire, that causes, that are often swept under the rug because they're just either A, not big enough, or not politicized enough. And we're talking about Ruth playing the September 11th card. I mean,
I was speaking before about how you write in your present moment, yeah. No matter what. I was writing in a post-September 11th world, and for a time, September 11th really eradicated the narrative concept of the present time, the present. Well, what is the present? Is it before, during, or after September 11th? And I think there was this paralysis for a lot of people about how do we metabolize this? How do we know what the future will be like? So how can we, in our present, write about the present for a present? It takes 10 months, 15 months, for a novel to be in bookstores. How do we know what the present will be? So when is the present? What is the present? And I think that was something that a lot of people really struggled with, and maybe in retrospect, for a comparatively short amount of time. Because we didn't know what else was going to happen. We didn't know whether this was a real before and after moment. In a way, I think it has turned into less of a before and after moment than we thought it would in the immediate aftermath of September 11th. I think life is much more normal and as it was for most people than it seemed possible to imagine back then. But it was very hard to know what present I was going to be writing about, the present reflecting back on September, on 1911, through this lens of September 11. And it made more sense to let it just be there than to try to focus on it you know, in the middle of the frame.
I'm wondering if you contemplated how, you know, during the writing in the present, if you contemplated how people would be viewing September 11th, say, you know, 90 years from now during writing this, if this was one of the...
Very interesting to imagine, yeah. Because just as we are now...
Talking about the triangle.
Approaching the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Fire. You know, David von Drehle's 2003 book on the Triangle Fire was one of about 60 books. I wrote a piece about this for Pages Magazine. There were at least 60 books that came out in the years after September 11th that were noun, colon, subtitle, the noun that changed America. And all kinds of things were the something that changed America. And one of them was triangle, colon, the fire that changed America. So David von Drehle's thesis was that it was the birth of the New Deal. And there's something to be said for that. Frances Perkins witnessed the fire. She became the first female cabinet, you know, minister, so to speak. You know, she was Secretary of Labor at the height of the New Deal. Von Drehle tries to make the case that women's suffrage was advanced. Women's suffrage advanced pretty slowly from there, if it took another decade. But it certainly strengthened unions. It certainly was a turning point in a sense of the immigrant experience. But in fact, I don't think the Triangle Fire loomed as large as we think it did or think it should have until the 1960s. And in my too much research on the fire, I discovered something really interesting, which is that there were really no books about the fire until the really important Leon Stein book in 1962, when he could still interview many, many survivors of the fire, witnesses of the fire. But starting in the mid-late 60s, there is a huge new industry of children's books about the Triangle Fire. And I really was puzzled by this. And they've continued. They come out every year. Why? The Triangle Fire for children. Why? And then it dawned on me, what's going on in the late 60s? The women's movement. It became a women's story. So every era looks at the past through its contemporary lens. I mean, the ultimate example of that would be Arthur Miller and McCarthyism and the Crucible. You know, so it's a woman's story now. It becomes a kind of a core sample of women's issues and you know, the immigrant experience that so many people have in their own family histories, but a woman's story. And I do think it was particularly compelling compared, say, to the Great White Fire or the Coconut Grove Fire, because it was work. They were working. They were just off the boat, you know, fresh from Ellis Island, trying to live the American dream, working hard. They weren't in a nightclub. They weren't having a good time. They were at work. And I think that's a particular, there's something particularly poignant about that. But it became a woman's story, and it has never let go. And so it is a story aimed at little girls. There are just endless stories about the plucky little immigrant girls who go to work at the Triangle Fire, and one lives and one dies. You know, I mean, it's just been completely taken over that way. And I don't know that that's a bad thing. I just know that in the 1940s and 50s, nobody much was talking about the Triangle Fire in the same way.
It's interesting you mentioned 1962, because that is actually also the year of the book, the fictitious book that you have in this as well.
Yes.
Was this kind of your, you know, again, the influence of Stein, perhaps?
Well, sure. The fictitious book I reference is very much the Stein book in that sense, because it's really sort of, you know, it's the record. And it made sense to me that information that might have come to light about things that went on at the factory having to do with sexual harassment or whether or not somebody had been raped or whether or not somebody had been treated badly by a boss could have come to light in those interviews, and he would have chosen, you know, I know nothing about Stein other than that he wrote about labor issues, but that someone who was privy to those people and their recollections may have been told things off the record that are not in that book and are lost now. So I was imagining that, and it was a way to sort of bring some of those possibilities into the story.
But then you have these sort of, I guess, double-edged sword here, because then you start really pissing people off when you ask them these deeply personal questions, as Ruth does in this.
Yes, and Ruth, of course, has access to his notes. Once again, we're back to what fascinates me so much, artifact, written notes, but what does it really mean? Because no matter what he wrote, we still don't completely know what it means, and she's trying to make sense of his notes. that are the notes underlying the book he wrote, but it isn't the book and it isn't the interviews. It's simply cryptic notes, and you still don't know what he didn't write down at all, or what notes are missing. Do we know for a fact that his son gave Ruth Zion all the notes? You know, so as many questions as are answered, more questions should arise. You know, and it's again, who gets to tell the story? How do we know what happened? You know, an artifact, it was never my intention to set out to write novels that have certain common elements, which when I look back, they have. And artifactness is in every novel I've written. You know, the literal existence of the narrative is part of the story.
I actually wanted to ask you, and this is just a purely curious question on my part, the name Bodkin, I kept thinking Shakespeare with that. Was that...
Bodkin is actually a Gershwin family name.
Oh, really?
His cousin Henry Bodkin was a painter who taught him to paint and also advised him on his art collecting and traveled with him in Paris and bought art with him.
That's hilarious, because I kept reading that thinking, oh, well, this is kind of like a sort of to be or not to be question, the triangle between the two extremes.
Right.
Yeah.
If you do an internet search on Gershwin plus Bodkin, yeah, you would find, this, you know, Henry Bodkin.
I should have known. Okay, well.
You know, every character's name in a novel usually has public and private meanings, and, you know, in a certain way, it's like naming your dog, you know, just, yeah, it has to feel right, it has to be the right name for this character. But most writers have layered reasons,
sure,
only some of which are apparent, for making choices like that.
Sure. Well, actually, I wanted to ask you about traditions. There are two references in this book to traditions. One is, near the beginning, where George's work is part of the composers who are basically ripping off George's work is part of the great American musical tradition. And then you have a moment later in which tradition is used in context with Thanksgiving and how George and Rebecca take Esther out every Thanksgiving to a restaurant. And there's this question of like, well, this is untraditional, you know, even though they're cooking a supposedly traditional meal, but yet the practice of actually going out to the restaurant each Thanksgiving is also tradition. I wanted to actually ask you about this. I mean, this idea of tradition and its connection with the idea of truth, is this kind of just another sort of, I guess, triangle here that I'm just perceiving, or just a kind of thing that kind of came of itself throughout the course of writing?
Well, you know, for the immigrant to America, Thanksgiving is a wonderful tradition because it isn't bound to one religious group. And although, yes, we can now talk about the smallpox blankets and the Indians and all of that, if you think of the sort of Hallmark greeting card version of Thanksgiving, it in the nicest, purest, sweetest, most innocent way, it is a universal holiday of good fellowship and being thankful for what you have. And it also is in the novel early in a description of how Esther and Pauline would try to have a little Thanksgiving in their apartment. And so, in a way, one of the things that is being echoed, and again, it's like the theme and variation in a musical sense, is Esther's Thanksgiving tradition over the years has mutated into this, let's not cook, let's go to a restaurant, it's just the three of them. You know, Rebecca and George have a tradition of not really liking Thanksgiving and avoiding it, you know. So there are all these echoes of what it means. I also know, I mean, when Annie and Joseph Albers arrived at Black Mountain College fleeing the Third Reich, which had just padlocked the Bauhaus, they arrived just before Thanksgiving, 1933. And their response to Thanksgiving was something I heard a lot about from Annie. And it was part of an Americanness. And I think that part of the immigrant experience is trying to figure out how to be American. And it's an ultimate sort of American symbol in that sense.
Well, also this other idea of the great American tradition of ripping off other great composers.
Appropriation.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Yes.
You know, how does that tie into this notion of Thanksgiving about we sit down and we eat, but we also have this tendency to just, I guess, mutate or sample or whatnot?
Well, one element that occurs throughout the novel is the concept of the fractal.
That's true.
And, in fact, Rebecca bakes fractal pies, which are the little baby extra pies that are a reference of the tradition she had with her grandmother. When her grandmother baked a pie, she would give her the little bits of dough to make a little baby pie, which is sort of a fractal. And now she makes a fractal pie, and George eats it in one bite. So it's being perpetuated into the next generation and the next generation. But fractals are interesting because, and it's a relatively new mathematic concept, it's only a few decades old, of something that is a recapitulation of the whole in the way that Sierpinski triangles occur in nature and an element is a recapitulation of the whole. And, you know, you're not speaking to a scientist, but I'm interested in the metaphors of forms found in nature and
well,
and
same
science.
Thing with the Fibonacci spiral. In fact, there's the whole scene I was mentioning earlier in Pi, that movie,
yes.
By Darren Aronofsky, who did Requiem for a Dream, and this other movie, which I'm blanking out on the most recent one. But he had this whole thing about how the Fibonacci spiral is found in everything, and the whole
pine cones.
Yeah,
I mean, it's spectacularly
exactly.
beautiful.
Yes. Exactly, seashells. There you go.
Yes.
You know, I mean,
yes.
it's everything. And I guess, but the thing is, and we didn't quite get into this, but the notion of looking for that pattern or really feverishly deconstructing for that particular pattern versus this idea of just instinctively sort of living. It's sort of, I mean, this kind of like...
Well, it's the difference between the novel and the life.
Yeah.
Life, as we live it, no matter how purposeful or driven we may be, or how programmed we may be, life is hectic and layered and frequently pointless and random.
Yeah.
We read novels and biographies because we are interested in lives that make sense and in cause and effect and in seeing the meaning behind the patterns. We see the patterns. A novel sees patterns and sees meanings and makes meanings. So if the cat is on the ledge and doesn't die, it's a way of recapitulating a better version of when people are on a ledge and they do die. And that's a pattern, that's a meaning. Life often has patterns, but unless you're analyzing your dreams with your therapist or the friends who are willing to tolerate hearing about your dreams, since their own dreams are interesting, other people's dreams less so, you know, in a dream analysis, you're encouraged to think, oh, there were three cracks in the sidewalk, and then there were three crows, and then the clock struck three times. I wonder, you know, why I'm thinking about that. In life, if you see too many patterns in your daily experience, moment to moment to moment to moment, we call that psychosis. Psychotics experience everything as having a meaning in relation to everything else, and you can't live that way. That's crazy. So we are trained to be social, organized, relatively organized creatures who screen out the meanings that we see all the time and feel all the time that are of no use to us and only make things incoherent and complicated. And we always try to look for the main event. So if you and I are sitting here in a restaurant on Montague Street in Brooklyn, if I see a woman at the next table who reminds me of my great uncle's first wife who nobody speaks to, you know, that's part of human experience. But if I start talking about that, then we're not answering your questions and we're losing our agenda here, we're losing our purpose. But life is full of patterns and associations. Or I see three people today and they all make me think of her. And then I pick up a newspaper headline and they mention the city where she was born. You know, am I psychotic? Am I seeing patterns that don't really exist? Well, in novels, the patterns are there. It's pleasing. Just as in music, it depends on pattern. I mean, music without pattern isn't music. So I think it's human nature to look for patterns, to enjoy experiencing patterns. We like repetition. We like connections from this to that. I mean, I think novelists are people who see connections and can make them pleasing when other people don't see them at all.
Well, you could also take this argument further with both with music and literature. Music, you have 12 notes arranged in any number of random manners, and there's still going to be a set number of patterns that you can actually lay down, depending upon the length, depending upon how many measures, etc. Same thing with there are only so many words in the English language.
But there's an infinite variety of, there's infinite possibility.
Yeah.
We own all the words, we own all the notes.
Yeah.
We can do anything with them. But it's patterns that are pleasing and randomness that we will only tolerate to a certain point within a larger pattern. You know, we still want to know when to expect it and when it's going to stop.
Mm. Interesting. Well, I actually wanted to ask you one, speaking of psychosis, there was one thing I wanted to ask you about, and I just have to find the exact phrase that you used. Oh yeah, here it is. It was in relation to a Beatrice Q&A you did with Mary Sherratt, and you referred to your usual crackpot magpie methods of research. And I wanted to actually ask you about this. Maybe you could clarify what you were referring to here, I mean, so that maybe our listeners here can make the call as to whether you're a crazy magpie or not.
Well, I don't have a college degree, although I now am a thesis advisor in an MFA program at Columbia, and I taught at Yale for 8 years. And I, you know, it's, I don't have formal training, which in a way is very freeing because no one ever told me I was supposed to think a certain way about things. I actually don't have a high school diploma either, so I'm really kind of a, you know, I'm unemployable as far as the post office is concerned. But I, you know, an autodidact. What is an autodidact? You know, an autodidact is a person who knows what autodidact means. You know, magpies, you know, just snatch up, you know, glittering gum wrappers off the sidewalk and, you know, take them home. You know, and I feel that in some ways to be the kind of fiction writer I want to be, you have to be open to experience, to details, to noticing. And a certain amount of crackpot research consists of, you know, eavesdropping on buses or making the most of the very long, boring line at motor vehicles to get your license renewed. Oh, if all these people are here to get their license renewed with me, oh my God, we're all Scorpios. What's going to happen now? You know, it is kind of allowing yourself to go wherever you're going.
Well, that's crackpot, though. I mean, that's a huge judgment to place on what is a very normal thing.
Maybe you're placing a judgment on what I mean by crackpot. Maybe I think that's a fine thing, but it's very non-standard. Yeah. It's not. I mean, one of the reasons I like going into the stacks in a library, of which there are fewer and fewer, because it's all searchable databases, is because you never know what you're going to see next to the thing you thought you were looking for. One of the reasons I like a physical dictionary, which is very different from looking up a word online, is because of what I call adjacent reading. You're looking for a word, and the next thing you know, an hour later, you know, you're reading all these other wonderful words in the dictionary that were pages that your fingers happened to touch that have nothing to do with the word you were looking up. And to me, that's a kind of magpie approach, you know, of just sort of whatever comes up next. It's also a very sort of ADD-ish way to sort of take in material. Sometimes, switching metaphors wildly here, sometimes another way of thinking about it is like certain kinds of sea creatures, certain kinds of whales and sharks who just vacuum up, they just hoover up enormous quantities of plankton all the time. They're just filtering all this, you know, all the krill, all the plankton. And I think that novelists are open to experience in those ways and open to interesting details, interesting little connections, interesting little stories about somebody who said something to someone and who knows why and who would be that person who would say that thing and where could that go in a story. You know, I flew back from Ireland 2 nights ago. I sat next to a woman who had 14 USA Todays for the 14 days she'd been away. I think they were FedEx to her in London. She'd been on a cruise. She actually didn't know the names of the countries where her boat had gone because she'd been in Antwerp, but she didn't know what country that was in. But she had her 14 USA Todays, and she read them in order on the flight home. Now, I have no plan to write a novel about a woman who must read her USA Todays no matter what. To me, that would have lasted 14 minutes, you know, but she obviously gets a lot more out of USA Today than I ever have. But it raises questions for me of who is she and why is she doing this and who would you have to be to want to do this and so on. So you just never know where someone like that turns up in some way in a story. So it's being receptive. It's being the opposite of a Ruth Zion. It's being receptive to whatever passes in front of you in a certain way.
Gotcha. Well, I'm about to run out of date, but it was a pleasure chatting with you, Catherine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.